And a little introduction about our speaker. Molly Andrews is a professor of sociology and co-director of the Centre for Narrative Research at the University of East London. Her research interests include the psychological basis of political commitment, psychological challenges posed by societies in transition to democracy, patriotism, conversations between generations, gender, ageing, and counter-narratives. She's widely published and a celebrated author. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you today. Molly, over to you.
Thank you. I have to say, I'm really delighted to be here and to have been invited to be here. I will try to keep my talk to a limited time so that we actually have time at the end to have questions and more importantly, really conversation, particularly connecting it to the kind of work that you guys are doing here, because I don't know much about that, and I think that there might be some very interesting crossovers. So thank you very much. And also to say that this is a bit of my old stomping ground, and I see some very wonderful and familiar faces and have come with some familiar faces, so that also feels really great. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I came to write this paper. And the paper that I'm giving is actually a presentation based on a chapter that I published in a book. And quite to my surprise, I received an invitation to talk about doing cross-cultural research. And as I got this, I thought, you know, that's actually really not me, to be honest. And I don't really know very much about that. I don't really think very much about that, and blah, blah, blah. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, actually, this is what I live and breathe, okay? I mean, in my person, in my own, you know, my own biography is in this picture. The reason I chose this picture is because people ask me where I'm from. And having moved to Cambridge, actually, in 1984, originally to do a PhD and sort of move between the States and here and a little bit in France, you know, my own identity is completely dispersed, and it's kind of in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Nobody owns me either side in terms of my accent. Wherever I am, I sound foreign, outsider, and yet a little bit insider too, perhaps. And so beginning with that kind of personal positioning, it's not that surprising that, in fact, my own research is very much also about exploring cultures of which I am sort of a part, but also sort of outside of. And that's what this paper is really about. And I'm going to set up some sort of theoretical questions and then actually explore them through uses of my own data. And I'll tell you a little bit more about different projects that I've done. And at the end, if you want to hear more about any of them, I can talk about them. But mostly, I'm really just trying to set up a set of questions more than anything else. So that picture is, as I say, I picked it really to represent where I feel I am in terms of these kinds of questions. So let's start here then with Erica Applebaum, a wonderful French psychologist who has done a lot of different kinds of very important work on cultural identity. And she says here, the issue of communicating across cultural boundaries is a major challenge to the very foundations of our dominant theoretical frameworks. Okay, she actually talks a lot about the importance of thinking about and theorizing what is other. And of course, the questions of what is other is very much connected to what is the self, what constitutes our very own identity. Applebaum's statement for cross-cultural narrative work are really profound. How is it that we access, interpret, and analyze stories which, at their heart, are distant from the experiences which we ourselves may have encountered, not only in our own lives, but in the accounts of others, which are part of our own narrative projects? So how is it that we prepare ourselves for the very, very demanding task of genuinely listening, i.e. listening, preparing yourself to be able to hear things that are outside your own experience and indeed are outside even beyond what you can anticipate or expect. And I think that as researchers, and I'm a psychologist, but sort of a broad, multidisciplinary kind of person, that's one of the questions we're always trying to do. We're trying to find out how is it that somebody in this acute situation, how is it that they make sense of it? But the challenge is, of course, to suspend your own meaning-making framework and to be able to really listen to what it is that somebody comes up with. So how is our own sense of identity affected by opening ourselves to the very different realities which are encountered by others? And I think that's a very important question. And as I said, I'm going to, in this chapter, think about that question in relation to three different projects, actually, that I have done. And I want to say that I think that cross-cultural narrative research, which is the kind of research really that I do, i.e. going and spending a lot of time with people recording their stories, that cross-cultural narrative research is actually predicated upon the importance of narrative imagination. And I'll talk more about the narrative imagination. This is actually a term that I borrow from Jens Brockmeyer, who's written quite a lot about this. But if we can't actually imagine other than that which we know, if we can't actually push ourselves and try to think what might this other possible life, this other possible existence be like, we are actually in a very, very restricted place of knowing. And that's really what I'm going to talk about today. So if we wish to access the frameworks of meanings for others, we must be willing and able to imagine a world other than the one that we know. And I argue that the narrative imagination, which Donohue describes as, quote, the seeing of difference, lies at the heart of cross-cultural research. And here, I always like to come in good company, so Marcus Aurelius, to become world citizens, we must cultivate in ourselves the capacity for a sympathetic imagination. So it's both, it's really this holding on and letting go. It's this sympathetic imagination makes us recognize that which is familiar, okay, but it's at the same time holding on to that which is different, the seeing of difference, as Donohue calls it. Here I put this image because I think for me it's kind of intriguing, you know, what you can and can't see, basically. And trying to negotiate and to navigate a landscape that is both familiar and unknown at the same time. Okay. Just a little bit about my own research. I'm a psychologist, but with a degree, my first degree was in politics, so really a political psychologist, and all of my work has been involved in trying to look at how people make sense of their lives in moments of political turmoil. And some of the research I'm going to talk to you about today comes from England, my PhD here, where Stephanie Maychek was, in fact, the librarian at Social and Political Sciences. I did my PhD right here on lifetime socialist activism. In the early 1990s, I did a project in East Germany looking at what it meant to the people who had helped to make that bloodless revolution. What did it mean once the country had disappeared? And then South Africa. And I happen to miss out here the United States as well. A project on patriotism and the meaning of what it means to be an American. Okay, so the question for me across these very different settings has actually been, how do the individuals with whom I'm speaking reflect not only reflect upon their own lived experience, but also very importantly, wider social and historical changes, which actually form the context of their lives. My belief is that if I somehow can bring myself to listen closely enough, there's so much to learn from these individual stories. But of course, it's very hard to open yourself to that kind of listening. And in fact, you often, when you're confronted with huge stacks of transcripts, you're always making decisions about this is relevant, this isn't. And yet what is to be considered relevant is something which is constantly moving and evolving. I mean, I've sometimes gone back and looked at transcripts and think, oh my God, I cannot believe that I didn't see that as being the heart and soul. So actually, our challenge is to understand what is the framework which lends meanings to these particular lives. So this will probably be a well-known citation for a lot of you. My sense of culture is very much that from it expressed by people like Geertz, who says here, you know, man is an animal suspended in webs of significance he himself has spun. Okay, well, he or she. I take culture to be those webs and the analysis of it to be an interpretive one in the search of meaning. And to me, that sort of complexity, that sort of multi-layer thing is the very thing which I'm trying to explore. Because for me, as for people like Gerritsen, and probably a lot of you in this room, culture really cannot be separated from meaning. And it's this teasing out, which is really a very challenging thing to do. So according to Gerritsen, culture is public, like a burlesque wink or a mock sheep raid. The thing to ask about a burlesque wink or a mock sheep raid is what their import is. And I think this is really the strength of the kind of work that we can do when we can sit for hours and talk with people about their stories, about their experiences, their passions, their conflicts, their regrets. It's only through doing something like that, which is really a profound opportunity to do with somebody, that we can actually even begin to ask what do these experiences mean to these people. What it is, ridicule or challenge, irony or anger, snobbery or pride, that in their occurrence and through their agency is getting said. So for Gerritsen, culture and meaning are accessed not through the universal and generalizable, but through exploration of fine detail. We must, he advises us, descend into detail. I just love his writing anyway. We must descend into detail. Seeing heaven in a grain of sand is not a trick only poets can accomplish. Yeah. So Erica Applebaum also writes in this grain, saying, the singularity of experience offers one of the possible ways to confront the universal, which I think is just, for me, that is really true. And Gerritsen, again, argues that good interpretation, quote, takes us into the heart of that of which it is an interpretation. And that's obviously the title of this talk will have probably rung a bell for some of you. It's this idea of that we don't actually interpret by being distant and outside, or that's one kind of interpretation, but indeed by becoming very messy and immersed in that very thing. So my research has always been guided by a similar outlook. This journey into the heart, as Gerritsen calls it, has most often taken the form of in-depth life history interviews. In fact, I say most often, I think it's always taken that form. And my guiding assumption has always been, as Robert J. Lifton described his own work, that the best way to learn about a group of people is to talk to them. And I've spent, actually, a lot of time, hundreds of hours, actually talking to different people about things that I actually know very little about, and trying to find out how it is that they make sense of their lives. Again, quoting Gerritsen, he describes the goal of his own research in the following way. We are not seeking either to become natives or to mimic them. Only romantics or spies would seem to find point in that. We are seeking, in the widened sense of the term, in which it encompasses very much more than talk, to converse with them. And I think that's very important. To converse with them, a matter of a great deal more difficult, not only with strangers, than is commonly recognized. And I think that this is a really critical point here, that the idea that, yes, we are in conversation with the people who we are researching, but that also we are... That is a very difficult thing to be. It's not a straightforward thing, and that even if you think about when does a genuine conversation actually happen, even in your personal life, where there is some kind of give and take, where you're open to hearing things, either that you don't like or that you don't expect or that you don't know about, it's quite a rare thing. It's a real psychological challenge to put yourself in that kind of position, and I think that, especially in research, which is what we're, after all, talking about here, that needs to be the role of the researcher who is entering into life history discourse. So again, the framework of my research projects has invariably changed over the course of research as I actually figure out that people hold different things important than I might have anticipated. And therefore, you know, I think many of us might have had this experience, that the very thing that we thought was important to research turns out not to be the key question at all. Now, here's a critical question of training then, because do you abandon what you thought was the right question and follow them, or do you actually you know, what kind of middle ground do you do here? Rosaldo, another one of my anthropology heroes, describes this interpretive approach, again, along with Geertz, in the following way. Ethnographers begin research with a set of questions, revise them throughout the course of inquiry, and in the end emerge with different questions than they started with. One's surprise at the answer to a question, in other words, requires one to revise the question. That's what's really important. The surprise requires one to revise the question until lessening surprises or diminishing returns indicate a stopping point. In other words, if you ask somebody something and their answer really doesn't make sense to you, it's your challenge to figure out, well, from what point of view does this make sense? From what point of view is this important? Because so often you actually read people's accounts of their research where they actually say, the person didn't answer my question. Well, maybe there's a problem with your question. Or maybe they were answering it. Maybe they interpreted your question in a different way than you had actually intended. And I think that removing ourselves from this position of certainty and actually saying, okay, so what does that actually mean? What are they trying to say here? That's a far, far more rich ground, I think, for learning. For me, I think that this kind of openness and the ability and the willingness to change your research as you go along, depending on what people are telling you, is actually close to their hearts, is something which is very important. And yet, it goes against the very kind of training that so many of us have received. So I have a little bit here, but I'm not really going to go on too much about that, about what are sort of typical kinds of instructions that we receive about doing cross-cultural research. And it's very much about having a very clear hypothesis, having a one-sentence question, sticking to it, and applying the very same question in different places, as if the very same words mean the very same thing no matter where you are. And for me, of course, it's not going to probably come as a big surprise that I don't think that really does work very well. I don't think that the same words mean the same thing, even to the same people across time. So that even if we wanted to take a snapshot that would hold the world as stable, it's impossible for us to do so. So that we actually, by the very fact of working with human beings, we have to be willing to accept that messiness and that idea that things are constantly changing. Let me move on a little bit here. So let's talk then more specifically about life history research and cultural practice, which is more what I bring to this conversation. Throughout most of my research, I have actually tended, as I said, to do these in-depth interviews with people, very much trying to elicit stories and trying to make sense, etc. But the way in which I have done this has by and large been by inviting one person, or it might be one person and a translator, into a room and turning on a tape recorder and taping them. And that's fine as far as it goes. But I actually think that the very way in which we collect our stories is also part of a cultural expression. And it's been my experience that sometimes people, that just doesn't really fit for them. Okay, this idea that we actually talk about ourselves as selves in a private room, one-to-one, that very thing actually decontextualizes us from the thing which we are trying to talk about. So why is it that we assume that social animals, such as human beings, make the most coherent or most meaningful sense of their lives when they are virtually stranded on their own with a stranger and a recording machine? Here I borrow again from the work of Qi Wang and Jens Brockmeyer, who describe autobiographical remembering as a form of cultural practice. They argue that the very notion of autobiographical memory is itself a cultural product. They say that individuals who are socialized in the West, quote, remember their past as if it were a drama in which the self is the leading player. Moreover, in the drama of one's personal history, the self acts in an all-determining totalitarian fashion. This way of thinking about autobiographical memory emphasizes individuality, autonomy, power, in in explicating and evaluating human lives. The Western, and here's the quote then from them, the Western notion of autobiographical remembering as intimately connected to the development of an autonomous self is only one possible form in which individuals remember their pasts. There also exist other cultural genres of remembering, such as genres that are connected to a process of increasing social relatedness. And I hope you appreciate my really nice pictures here contrasting these two kinds of viewpoints. Well, in fact, I have found this to be, you know, I think there are things that you do gain when you have one-on-one conversations with people. I'm not abandoning that altogether. But I also want to say that there might be things that we compromise on as well. And reflecting on this, I'll give two examples of in this work which I had done with lifetime socialist activists. When I was very much, and much more of a trained up and full card-carrying psychologist in those days than I would claim to be now, I was very interested in overt expressions of identity, and I asked people about identity, which is not something I probably would do these days, but in any case, some people found this a really, really troubling question, actually, and here are two examples. Both of these are people who had been politically active on the left for 50 years or longer, really full-time out there activists. So Eileen says to me, I asked her what was her experience about of reading the transcript of us, and she says, I found it rather shocking because I felt it was very self-indulgent. I.e. self-indulgent because we sat around and talked about her for a few hours. And she was doing me this favor, right, answering this. I found it really self-indulgent. I think that's what hit me, and I think after our discussion, I had felt the same. My reactions were, oh dear, we do try to get away from our egos. How do you break out of the circle of your ego? And here I am locked into it. Now, just to complicate that, I'm not saying she does feel that, but actually, what's also interesting is that at 95, she, in fact, last year, just published her autobiography. Okay, and I do think that actually part of that process of reflecting in this sustained way over 3 years did help her to think, you know what, I would like to write this story too. So I don't want to say it's either or, it's complicated. Mary, similar thing. I don't think of myself as having an identity. Perhaps you, as the younger generation, think more in that kind of way. I wouldn't think many people go on consciously thinking about themselves, really. Would that it were so. I love that, but never mind. So interestingly, my respondents had their own creative ways of circumventing what they saw sometimes as an overly individualistic orientation, which underlay my chosen methodology. And not only would we be alone in a room, but of course their stories were, by their very essence, very social stories. Even when I trapped them alone and closed the door, there were people, their stories were highly peopled stories, and then they did the most awful thing. They subverted the whole research design because they wanted to meet each other. And this was incredible. They did, in fact, meet each other. I rented a room in a house, and the whole house was full of these wonderful aging activists and me sort of giving everybody tea and brownies and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, what are they going to think about? But that was them. They actually they needed that as that social element. And I thought that was very powerful. They were willing to go along with my research design, but they needed something else as well. Let's move on a little bit. In the context of the research in East Germany, which, as I said, I did in the early 90s, three of the women I interviewed, Irene Kukuz, Berbel Bolay, and Katja Hoffman, had formed a group called Women for Peace, and that might be a name that's familiar to some of you. They were very much influenced by the Greenham women. Berbel Bolay, who she was the face of the East German Revolution, she was in the West, and she was called the Mother of the Revolution, which was a name she actually hated. Berbel Bolay just died about 2 weeks ago, and she actually was, it was very widely covered here and in Germany. It was actually as if a head of state had died. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. But in any case, these three incredible women had formed this group, Women for Peace, and in the summer of 1989, as thousands began to pour out of East Germany through the Hungarian border, these three friends sat together in their garden and promised one another that the following year they would travel to Italy, a place which for them represented all that had previously been forbidden to them. Indeed, the following summer they did go together. Irena Kukuc describes this experience to me. When we were crossing the Alps, I had the same feeling as when the border opened. Total collapse. I was thinking, by what right, with what justification, did they imprison us for years, and why couldn't I see that, the view from the Alps earlier? One somehow felt cheated over a chunk of one's life. Well, 2 years later, in 1992, when they opened the files for the East German Secret Service, the Stasi, they said that, in fact, people could come, they could apply to come and see their files, but they had to do them individually. You had to come on your own. And on the second day that the records were opened, these three women went to see what their files contained. As I say, although it had been stipulated by the Gauck Commission that the files must be read only by individuals, these three women disregarded this and insisted on seeing their files together. Irena Kukuc explains the reasoning behind their determination. We are all in the files together, and we are going to look at them together. And I thought this was really very moving, actually, and their sort of refusal to be individualized, to be taken out of the context, which was the only context that really lent meaning to what they had been doing. Okay, let's move forward a little bit then. The next section here really talks about the problem of ethics and cultural positioning, which I think is a very complicated one. We as researchers are influenced by our culture, not only in our expectations of the conditions under which people might feel most inclined to give an account of their lives, but also in the very ways in which we're taught to go about trying to get this information, and indeed what it might mean to have access to this information. So it's not just about how we form our research questions, or indeed even how we go about methodologically, but it's also about what does it mean to have that information. And this is governed by all sorts of things, like, you know, our guidelines for consent and anonymity and confidentiality and all of that whole research protocol, which are assumed to be universal, but in fact which are very particular, and in some settings are indeed very, very alienating. So here I would like to move to an example of some research in South Africa, where, as you might know, the transcripts of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission first of all, the 22,000 people gave testimony in front of the TRC. When people did so, they actually gave consent for their transcripts to be made available. The bottom line was very few people, probably no one, ever had any idea of what this consent actually meant. I think probably people might have thought it meant for the research purposes of the TRC, because it was clear that there was a research arm of it. But in fact what it meant was that those transcripts were available. They all are available to all of us online. All you have to do is just click through them. And this question of open access, which was defended by many people, it was like, this is really unique data, and anyway, we have permission to use it. This question of open access proved to be extremely problematic and psychologically damaging for many of the people who gave testimony. And yet the defense of it that I have heard time and time again has been so problematic, because people defended saying, well, we got consent, okay? So here, I want to give an example by somebody who was a former anti-apartheid activist, a former officer in the Mkutu, the military wing of the ANC. And he describes his experience of giving testimony to the TRC. He says, it took me almost a year to recover psychologically from my testimony and the form it took publicly after having testified. He says, at the time of my testimony, I had no idea what the consequences of public could have meant in the context of public hearings. The fact that my testimony could be appropriated, interpreted, retold, and sold was not what I had expected. Serious thought needs to be given to the ethics of appropriating testimony for poetic license, media freedom, academic commentary, and discourse analysis. Arguing these lines and it's on the public record are two easy positions to take, since they do not address the rights of self-authorship and the intention of the speaker, the reclamation of one's voice and one's agency. And I think that Yasir Henry is a pretty inspirational person, actually, and he makes this argument very forcefully. But the general issues that he raises are not really just unique to South Africa. I think this whole question of, and indeed they're not even necessarily unique to traumatic testimony. The emotional ante might be raised in traumatic testimony. But the question of whose data is it? And what does it mean when somebody says, yeah, you can use it? What does that actually mean? Those still remain problems for a lot of us. They should remain problems. Jane Selby actually discusses the complexity of conducting responsible research across indigenous setting. Her research, which involves children in a remote indigenous community in Australia, explores candidly some of the intractable challenges which are incurred when working across divides of disadvantage. She says, we use traditional methods and practices to help avoid experiencing the difficulties of working with others. But in such hiding from uncomfortable experiences, we do our work less well. And I think that's the point that that we actually need to confront that difficulty and to think, what does it actually mean to do this kind of research? And not to always have these certain answers is very important. So Jane Selby says here, while working fairly with disadvantage might be an ideal, which is impossible, a fantasy of good research, teaching, or good politics, there is nonetheless much to be learned in exploring what lies beyond one's cultural boundaries. Cultural uncertainty affords creativity. And I think this idea that cultural uncertainty affords creativity is something which, as researchers, we really would do well to take on board. That, in fact, not knowing all the answers, in fact, being open to confronting some of the discomfort that our own inside or outsider tension, where that places us, in fact, gives us an opportunity not only to learn personally, but to open up windows of things which might be knowable across different kinds of cultures. Okay. I'm going to turn now to talk a little bit about narrative and national identity. It's not wholly surprising that my work, which has been based in several countries and sometimes simultaneously so, has led me to think about how people position themselves vis-a-vis the country of their birth and/or the country of their residence. I've spent hundreds of hours listening to people tell me stories about themselves and their countries. And they've taken all sorts of different kinds of forms, very often some kind of, you know, micro history lesson, and very much stories about how and where the state is either celebrated, denied, or acknowledged in their own personal life. And one of the challenges really has been for me to be sufficiently knowledgeable about the history that they are talking about in order to be able to engage in some kind of a meaningful way. So that's actually led me on some pretty intense reading of history, to the extent that I know a lot more about portions of British history, for instance, in the 20th century than I do about that in the United States, because of I spent the first 18 months of my PhD doing nothing but reading history and, you know, visiting various archives, etc. And the same was true for my research in East Germany. Now, that's an interesting thing, because what it means is when you assume that you are outsider, you do a lot more legwork than you might otherwise do when you think, I actually know about this stuff. So in the research, in preparing for the research in the UK, As I said, I read a lot of the social history, especially of the interwar years and the rise of the Communist Party in this country, etc. And I want to just show some of the data that I gathered from that, which was stuff that I really didn't know a lot about. So one of my interviewees was a guy called Walter Gregory, and he had joined the National Unemployed Workers Union, participated in the hunger marches to London in 1934. He developed a political understanding of the circumstances which had led to massive unemployment, of which his own job loss was but one statistic. One of the things about reading this history so intensely is, in a bizarre way, you really do get a sense of deja vu, you know, over time. And, you know, reading and going back and reading some of the things they said about those times, I feel like I'm looking forward as well. It's very strange. So he explains the effect of becoming politicized. He said, "The things I learned in 1934 on the hunger march, I hold fast to this day. I was never the same after that hunger march. I could never go back to being just the same person." And he was convinced that that what he learned on that hunger march was actually something of wider significance. And indeed, I would see that kind of story replicated time and time again, that personal biographies actually can only be understood in this wider context of historical, really, fights. And Christopher Cornford, who actually was from Cambridge here, he was another one of my respondents, and he explained to me the situation, the time in which they all became politicized. He says, "You can see it, can't you, how unemployment, fascism, war preparations, political reaction, one knew that all the right-wing conservatives were really anti-Semitic and pro-Hitler in their heart of hearts, and they really wanted Hitler to attack Russia. One saw in Russia this wonderful, creative, just, egalitarian society with infinite potential, and everything seemed to add up, and everything seemed to cut the same way." And he describes the dramatic effect of his political conversion. You suddenly see the world in a different perspective. The world becomes much more luminous and exciting and comprehensible and evolving and significant. And you feel that you have a sort of function in the world as distinct from being a little dry leaf that's being blown around in the wind. And for me, this was really, they were telling me stories about a time that I didn't know and about a country that I had only just moved to, but they were fully engaging stories as well. I want to turn now and talk about some research that I did in East Germany. I'm going to push myself along so we have time. My research in East Germany was very different in a number of ways to the research that I had done here in Britain. When I arrived in East Berlin in February 92, first of all, East Germany no longer existed, despite the fact that that's what I was going to be doing my research on. I have to change my research question. However, during my 6 months there, it occurred to me that it might be easier to wipe nations from globes than it is to wipe a sense of national identity from individual consciousness. And as many people observed, times of political upheaval are particularly ripe conditions for collective narrative reconstruction. And they took down most of the wall, except for a very teeny token bit, very, very quickly. But nonetheless, even when I was there in 92, most of the wall didn't exist any longer, okay? And yet that's what people wanted to talk about, right? That's what was lingering for them in terms of where their identity was. So I'm here, I'm quoting here from Jens Reich. Now this is what's interesting here, just to the circle within the circle. This is actually based on a talk that Jens Reich gave at Lady Mitchell Hall here, just before the elections, which basically where East Germans, for the first time in their life, had the right to vote, and the first thing that they did as people with the right to vote was to vote their country out of existence. And this is Jens Reich talking here in Cambridge. And he talks about, he said, wall sickness was the eternal lamenting analysis of our life blighted and circumscribed by the wall, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to rush you through that because I want to get us to other bits as well. It's not just a condemnation of living in the within the boundaries of the wall. It's also about an attachment to those limitations at the same time. Strange to say, I'm not happy and neither are others around me. Okay, we kind of miss that thing. Now, what's really interesting is that we hear that on November the 9th, 1989, that people were absolutely cheering and that this was a very, very moving experience, etc. And yet, a lot of the people who I spoke to, because of who they were politically, had a very, very different sense of this. Berbel Bolay, who I told you about earlier, she told me, I said, what did you do the night of November the 9th? And she said, I made myself a stiff drink and I went to bed for 3 days. Okay, hardly a sense of jubilation. So here, this is excerpts from an interview I had with somebody called Reinhard Wiesen, who was one of the founders of the Initiative for Peace and Human Rights, really one of the great opposition activists. And this is his response to this question. This is the longest excerpt I'm going to give you because it's to me very, very moving, and it tells you a lot. And again, if you think about me as a real outsider, but being very much brought in by this story, and where he's telling me this is actually in his own living room, which is literally a few feet from where the wall opened. Okay, I'll show you the picture of that. So I say, well, so what did you do on the night of November the 9th? And he says, on the way home at about 10:30, I noticed many people all running to the same direction. They were all running to the end of the world. Just love that, to the end of the world. It was just over there, other, you know. The street was full of cars. No one could hardly walk. I then walked with the stream and got to the border crossing of Bolhammerstrasse, which was the first crossing to be opened, 200 meters from here. I mean, it was right there. And that's actually the picture of outside his house from that night. It was so crammed full with people you couldn't move, and everybody was pushing through the crossing. The policemen were just standing around. They didn't know what to do, completely puzzled. I asked a few people what was happening. Of course, I know I could see, but I didn't understand. But this idea of the East German policemen just standing around, not knowing what to do, because, of course, their old role, that would be them, was clearly in a time of dramatic change. And I stood there for about half an hour in this crowd and then went home and switched the television on. As you probably will know, although they couldn't actually leave East Germany, they did actually get reception for Western television, which lots of them watched Western television. So this is the interesting. Then I watched everything on the television, i.e. as transmitted from the West. Transmissions from everywhere, from the Kudamm, all the other border crossings. And I could see that people were coming over, this inverse, were coming over. That is a scene from the West. I was totally paralyzed. All this continued for the next few days, and it took me a whole week before I went across at Potsdamerstrasse. It's difficult to describe. This was such a very elementary transformation of one's existence, of the whole world, in a way. And then he turns to me, this very intense, he says, I'll try to explain. I have lived, I have been in Berlin. This, when I say I have lived, that was just a long pause. I have lived, I have been in Berlin since 73. I've always lived 200 meters from the wall. And this wall, to me, has become a symbol of captivity in every respect, also in a metaphoric, symbolic sense. And this is what I've been ramming my head against for the last 20 years. And I had, as a way of survival, I had resolved to ignore this wall as far as I could. And I tried to do the same throughout the week when the wall had gone. I did not only try to suppress the fact that the wall had been there previously, but I also tried to suppress the fact that it had gone. And it didn't work. When I went across the wall for the first time, I did so at Potsdamerplatz, where there hadn't been a crossing. They had only torn a hole, simply torn a hole into the wall, yes, and that's where I wanted to go through, precisely there. I walked through like a sleepwalker. I could not conceive of the idea up to the moment when I was through that that was possible. Well, and then I stood for a very long time over at the other side in no man's land and could not move forward nor backwards. And then I cried. I was totally overwhelmed. Now, there's so much in this story. I mean, we could really spend a very long time on this, thinking about culture and stories and him telling me as a clear outsider and what he calls on and also what is physically there to help frame that story. But in terms of the kind of work that I do, I think that the whole original idea about Geertz, you know, seeing a universe in the grain of sand, I think you really want to understand the complexity of what happened to East Germans in the transformation of their country. You need not look much further than that kind of a story. Here's a different kind of story, but another cultural story, which is about me trying to do some research in, quote, my own country. I'm going to give you a little bit of background here on statistics here. Hold on a second. I need to catch up with myself. Okay, so when I first completed my PhD here in Cambridge, the first job I had, first proper job I had after that, brought me back to the United States. And so I was supposedly, quote, moving home, back to my country. But I had moved from Cambridge, Massachusetts to Cambridge, England, and they're not really that very different. They are different, yeah, but they're not nearly as different as Cambridge, England is to Colorado Springs, Colorado, which is where I got my job at Colorado College. Well, much to my unfortunate what happened is that when I moved back there, literally the Gulf War had just broken out, and I was actually working in this context of the most militarized place in the United States. One might therefore think maybe one of the most militarized places in the world. Okay, this was really ground zero. It's where the Christian right meets all of, you know, there's five military establishments in the vicinity of Colorado College. It's incredible. And then the war breaks out. It's something like 55% of the total economy of Colorado Springs is involved in the defense industry. I mean, it's incredible. So when the war broke out, very interestingly, there was a anti-war vigil, 24/7. Okay, in a median, in the middle of the town, where people in the middle of the Rocky Mountains basically set up a camp to protest the war. And what was really, really interesting about this is that they placed a little American flag there. Okay, I wanted to know, what does it actually mean to be an American in this, and what does that flag mean? And this flag, more than anything else, made people furious. It's fine if you're going to be anti-war protesters. You know, you really should be forced to leave the country. But the idea that they were doing so, and in doing so, claiming their American citizenship, actually set people into a complete rage. And I write here a little bit about friends William Carlos Williams has written that there are no ideas but in things. And my research in Colorado Springs could be described as an exploration of the meaning of one particular object, the American flag. What did this symbol, these 13 red and white stripes with the 50 stars on the blue background, what did this mean to those people who displayed it? Part of this exploration was a journey inwards. What did this flag mean to me? What does this flag mean to me? And so here is what some of the reports of people actually who lived at that vigil. The people of Colorado Springs pelted us with snowballs, not as in a snowball fight. Bottles, beer cans, tennis balls, you name it. They spat on us, tried to run us over. There were a couple of times in which people with huge American flags tried to hit us over the head with actual flagpoles and sort of drape the flags over our heads. There was another time when this pickup truck with some rednecks stopped next to the vigil, and they harassed us for a while, and then they ran around us with their flag in a circle. You know, to me, this was a really strange thing that this was actually, quote, coming home. This didn't really feel very much like coming home. One thing which we clearly did not have in common, myself and the people who were perpetrating that violence, was a sense of what our shared national identity actually meant. If culture is, as Geertz suggests, inextricably bound to questions of meaning, then in a very profound sense, those who physically threatened the anti-war protesters were operating within a very different cultural framework from me, a framework which alienated and saddened me in equal measure. It was a contest over this meaning of national identity, my national identity, and our shared national identity, more than anything else, which was being physically fought over with the weapon of the U.S. flag. I'm going to close now. Sorry about this. Because I realize I talk too much, so we don't have much time. Okay, so my experience was not so dissimilar from that reported by Somerset Maugham. When I go back, I know I shall be out of it. We fellows who've spent our lives out here always are. And this idea of actually this ever-shifting place of where we sense that we do or we don't belong. Maybe those of us who live and work between cultural boundaries are forever destined to be out of it in this sense, or perhaps more accurately, simultaneously occupy the contradictory positions of insider and outsider. Our narrative imagination is our most valuable tool in our exploration of others' worlds, for it assists us in being beyond the immediately visible. It's our ability to imagine other possible lives, our own and others, that creates our bond with diverse social and historical worlds. Without this imagination, we're forever restricted to the world as we know it, which is a very limited place to be.
Thank you very much for a wonderfully enriching kaleidoscopic talk with so many strands and ideas that speaks to the heart of sociocultural anthropology, really. I'm sure there are many questions. Let me just kind of kick off with one, which I was thinking about being allowed not to know, right? And going into a situation where you don't have all the answers, and don't even have the questions, and sometimes ask a question, and the answer is something to which you've not yet worked out what that question is. Mm. And I think also about how in these increasingly compressed, instrumentalized times of a three-year or four-year PhD for some of our students, how having the right not to know is increasingly difficult. You're constrained and sort of pushed through, not a cookie cutter, but a kind of way of thinking about things.
Yeah.
And I wonder, therefore, whether sort of metaphor, analogy from languages and linguistics helps a little, thinking through this idea that if you are multilingual to begin with, or plurilingual, bilingual even, then you already know that there are these other worlds out there. And then the cross-cultural step is not such a great one to make, because you're not being confronted all the time by how limited your knowledge is. And in a sense, the growth of the mind, the potential of reasoning and of classifying the world around you, if you have more languages, perhaps you also have new ways of understanding narrative.
Okay, I would say, first of all, the first half of your question, yeah, I was completely with you.
Okay.
I'm a little bit more cynical than you are maybe about. I mean, I think it's wonderful. The more languages you know, the better. But I'm not completely sure that just having, even when you're trying to talk in your own native language, mm-hmm, you still are confronted with the thing about talking across and over differences, even with your partner, your sister, your child, right? I think one of the things, the biggest challenge is even more than trying to learn a new language, mm-hmm, okay? I think the biggest challenge is to actually sit and say, I really don't know. And I think we're tempted to know. If I did research on my family, I would start by thinking, I know a lot.
Right.
My research might therefore be quite a bit less good than yours, maybe, who knows, because of my starting firm expectations of all that I do know. So my emphasis would be, yes, of course it is important to know other languages, but I actually think that this whole thing about holding on to the importance of being in that place of not knowing is and actually being guided in different directions is actually important. And just a small anecdote here is that a few years ago, I was asked to give a talk to our PhD students, and I think they thought I was going to talk about, you know, my own research and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, you know, actually, that's pretty boring, and I've written about that. They can read that. I thought, what do I wish that somebody had said to me when I was a PhD student? And the whole talk was about the importance of uncertainty and how our critical training works in some ways to our favor, but also closes down a lot of doors. Because the moment you're sitting there trying to find the hole in somebody's thought, okay, which we all have inconsistencies, there's holes in all of our thinking, but if you are only driven in that way, and you have a framework which you've been encouraged to develop, and you're constantly seeing how well stuff fits into the mold that you've already established, that actually shuts down a lot of things we can know. That's what I think.
Sure.
And so, anyway, that was the paper that I gave to them. And I wish that somebody had actually said that to me rather than you know, furthering this need for, quote, rigorous methodology. Whereas I think this really does demand a rigorous methodology. It's a constant checking and rechecking on yourself. But it is actually saying there might be ways and things to know that simply are beyond my ken.
Yeah. So, and language may not help.
It might help, and it might not.
I'm sure there are other questions.
Maybe not.
Oh, I'm sure there are.
Just to ask a question about what the definition really and limits of narrative research are in your context. That's something I'm curious about, because I know your center is called the Center for Narrative Research. And I ask that question as an anthropologist, where I guess what I might kind of guess to be narrative research is one of several integrated methodologies, but not something that stands alone. Life history work or other kinds of interviews are done in concert with other kinds of quote-unquote participant observation or methodologies that focus on people's actions within a broader social sphere rather than simply just on discourse and what they say. And you seem to be alluding to some of the problems with the methodology that focuses only on that when you talked about people being alone in a room and how that's very sort of unnatural for many, many people. So I was wondering, the way that you conceptualize it or have worked with it in these projects, if it is also one methodology alongside others, or if it's an exclusive methodology, or how it relates to the kind of broader reality.
The way I think about that, the way I think about my own work, is very much relating what I would call micro and macro political narratives. So, sure, if all you ever are doing is actually sitting alone with somebody in a room, I mean, in some ways I caricatured that, because I also, you know, I spent so much time with these people. I stayed in their homes in a lot of situations. I went to, demonstrations with them. I did all sorts of things with them, which we could characterize in all sorts of other methodological ways. But I wanted to make a point here. My own belief is that if you actually think, if you want to understand those stories, you actually need to be able to think, how do they connect not only to wider stories that person is living, which is true within their community, but also structurally, socially, other stories. And, in terms of a, quote, definition of narrative, I probably won't be much for you on that one. You know, I mean, we did actually recently, our center recently published a book called Doing Narrative Research, which is a lot on that. But basically, my honest answer would be to you, there's probably as many definitions of that as there are people who profess it. And as somebody who's involved in organizing various speaker series about it, I mean, I'll go up to somebody and say, you know, hey, you know, would you like to come and give a talk? I think your work's really, oh, you know what, I don't do narrative research. I said, you know, funny thing is, I know what you do, and from my point of view, what you do is narrative. On the other hand, person X says, oh, yeah, I'm a narrative. I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. I mean, I don't feel like, playing God, holding the keys to the, and these days, you know, the much trumpeted, the narrative turn, I think, makes it much, much more complicated. Sometimes I think we should just abandon the term. I don't, and we don't. Obviously, we have that center. But I think that it can cause, and the way that we think about it is in the broadest umbrella kind of way. You know, there are a lot of people say, what? You know, how can you think of, you know, this broad spectrum of things as including narrative, whereas really it needs to have very clear sets of nuts and bolts. To me, I'm less interested in that, although it is a question of language. Sometimes I think it'd be easier if we called it chair or something. You know, just, you know, get out of that whole circle of debating who gets to name it, you know.
I wonder if you could talk about the question of kind of media technology. So you were saying that a lot of times you make an audio recording, I assume, of the discussion that you're having, but then you go over that and you make that into a transcript, and then from the transcript you make textual products. So why not potentially consider audio products where you actually kind of cut, you know, in the same way, you cut the interviews together, or documentary film work. You know, it's like, why kind of like border, why stick to the textual when the collection methods are from a different media technology?
Yeah.
Asking this in many ways from the question of kind of like talking across use of cultural difference, but in a way there's almost immediate differentiation.
Yes,
it's
also taking place. Here again, I mean, first of all, I happen for historical reasons as well to do the stuff that I do, and I could, but I'm not very purist about it. I wouldn't, like, if, you know, like some of our students, for instance, who are doing masters in narrative research, actually, it's been really popular with documentary filmmakers, okay, who have done some really wonderful work. I mean, from my point of view, that's very much connected to narrative, visual narratives. A lot of visual narrative stuff is actually coming out of our research center now, and I think that's really, really important. So that's the first thing to say, yes, you know, and two is I'm really sort of pathetic with technology, so that's another issue, but that's a bad excuse, and we'll put that over there. But number three is a more contentious point, really, which is I'm borrowing here from the research of one of our recent PhD students, Linda Sandino, who, in fact, has been an oral historian for more than a quarter of a century, and she works at the V&A Museum. And Linda's PhD actually argued, in a sense, against this idea that video and visual recordings are by necessity more than audio recordings. And the whole idea and her argument, I think, it's compelling, actually, because I think people think, you know, if only we could see them, we'd get the real thing. Thus ignoring, I think it's almost like you're just postponing the whole question of representation, okay? Whereas I would say in the transcripts that I produce that I really am producing those, right? They are very much a creation of Molly Andrews and a number of decisions which I have made and a number of imperfect and limited decisions that I have made. But that imperfection and those limitations, they might not be the exact same ones, but I think they apply to all kinds of data gathering. So I think that in response to this question, you know, why aren't you videoing them, or why aren't you asking them to keep diaries, and why aren't you actually talking to their kids? There's all, you know, you're always, you make decisions, and I think what's important is to acknowledge what those decisions are and what the limitations of those are, okay? And I would say, you know, if I had video recording, I would have something else, okay? But I'm not sure that it would necessarily be more, okay? And the other thing about working with transcripts, but maybe that's just me. I mean, there is a certain kind of thingness about them, okay? You send them back to people, and they use them. They, you know, I've spent many, many hours talking with people about transcripts. We might do the same thing if we were talking about a video, I don't know. But they tend to actually, you know, I've had people write back to me when I've sent them transcripts. I have a whole part in my office where I have letters from people who have written back to me reflecting on the written word as they saw themselves, as they, you know, as it appeared to them. They say, you know what, I see what you have written here. I see these transcripts. I know that I say it. I said that. But on reflection, it actually looks pretty weird to me. What I really meant was this, this, and this. And from my point of view, all of that counts as data. You know, it's all fair game.
And I wonder, you know, I don't know if this is a fair question, but how do you deal with silences?
It's a great question.
How do you deal with what isn't said, with what you know is there, but people aren't talking about, with the people that aren't telling you their stories, that you know they must be out there not telling you their stories?
It's not only a fair question, it's a great question. It's a central question. In fact, I'd be happy to send you if you want. I mean, I actually recently published a paper which was called Beyond Narrative, and it's looking at traumatic testimony and especially the importance of silence and how people, you know, how do you work in that? How do you work with this kind of material acknowledging the importance of silence? I think it's important, it's very important to have as a starting position that people never tell you everything. They simply can't and they don't, so they're making selections all the time. And again, it's getting back to this thing about what we don't know and accepting the limitations about what we can say. One thing that I would say is I find it very, very difficult as a researcher to hear the overconfidence that some people can read into silence, okay, because of their commitment to certain theories or whatever, you know. And I find that deeply problematic. I find it really offensive and insulting as well. I think you need to simply say, there is silence here, not I can tell you what it means, okay? And that's the one thing I feel really strongly about. And I've read and thought a lot about how do you actually, quote, narrate silence, you know? And in the paper that I just mentioned, I cite some works which really talk about the importance of marking silence and marking the territory of silence as actually being the most important thing, rather than trying to discern the meaning from that, because that's really one step too far. So that's how I would respond.
How do you go about understanding your narratives if you adopt a very open position in the very beginning where you don't have any answers, of course? But you have a theme maybe in the back of your mind, but yeah, do you start from that theme, or do you have any steps you go through when then looking at a transcript?
I'm going to sound really self-promoting here, but I think you should read Doing Narrative Research. But no, I'm half teasing, but I think it's how do you analyze these narratives? Well, actually, I would say that you have two challenges. One is the first one, which is really much more what this paper was about, is actually trying to figure out what other people mean, okay? But from my point of view, it's equally important to acknowledge that you might understand somebody's life very differently from the way they understand it. And since the end goal for me is not simply recording their lives, okay, but actually is part of a larger project of trying to understand lives and times, I feel fully entitled to actually say this is what they think, but actually this is what I think. Let's say you do, let's be, you know, sort of caricature here, and say you do a life history, a wonderful, deep, thoughtful life history with Hitler. Okay, or in fact,
has just been an exhibit of it.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay. It's not very interesting to have as a starting point, this is a bad guy, this is, you know, if that's all you're going to do, don't even bother. Don't waste that person's time, and don't waste your own. Don't even waste the paper. You know, that's not very interesting. What's much, much more important, for instance, like Robert J. Lifton's work, which I cited earlier, the work that he did with Nazi doctors, is to try and figure out how people who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could dedicate all of their skills and knowledge to perfecting ways, better, more efficient ways of killing people. That's an interesting question. What did it mean from their point of view? Now, what he doesn't do is actually then go one step further and say, okay, I understand how they made sense of it, and so therefore I agree with them, and it's all okay. No, it's not all okay, okay? But you take that understanding, the understanding that people offer to you, and then you actually have your own ideas as well, hopefully backed up by your substantial research, etc., and you see how those fit together. I mean, usually in my kind of work, if there's the opportunity, I will actually offer somebody, the books, for instance, that I've published using this kind of work, I mean, I always, before they are in a book form, I would present them, well, not in every case, but when possible, I would present people with my analysis of what they've said. Not that I hope that they agree with it, that's fine if they don't, but also it's important for me to always write with the idea that even when I am disagreeing with somebody, that I'm doing so in a respectful way, in a way that I would actually feel comfortable with them reading. Mm-hmm. So I do know some researchers who would actually say, I mean, this one woman who was going to publish something that's in an edited volume we were doing, and we came back to her and said, you know, I think this is a bit of a funny way you're talking about your respondent. Would you like to alter a few things here? And he's never going to read it. You know, and that actually is really not okay. And there's a wider issue there about, do we as academics feel in sort of a safe space to talk amongst ourselves in academic language, you know, these special places, because they're never going to read it. Well, no, I think that's not okay either. So it's actually bringing together these very different levels of interpretation, and indeed maybe very different ways of making sense of things and putting them together with what at the end of the day is your research question. You know, I say, okay, you need to be open, but you also need to know what you're doing your research on. Otherwise, it's a serious waste of time for everybody as well. So